Today we are going to have a public examination of a doctoral thesis entitled Cooperative Spectrum Sensing Schemes for Future Dynamic Spectrum Access Infrastructures, authored by Younes Abdi. As an opponent, we have Professor Markku Juntti from Oulu University, Center for Wireless Communications. As a custos appointed by the faculty, I hereby declare the public discussion opened. The spectrum sensing quality, which so we are going to discuss about cooperative spectrum sensing schemes for which is realized by cognitive radios, and I will discuss about spectrum sensing briefly, why it is important, and how it affects the performance of cooperative sensing. How that one influences the performance. We'll see that cooperative sensing, among the cooperation among the radios will enhance the performance. We will discuss several phases of cooperative spectrum sensing, and we will discuss the identified trade-offs proposed sensing methods we have provided in this dissertation to improve the existing cooperative sensing performance. Visually use this picture to visualize the in the radio communication we use radio waves with different spectrum bands. Very similar to what we see here. A white beam of light, which is decomposed into several colors. And as you see, here we have a signal. This is a kind of a white beam is decomposed into several colors, and which means this is composed of several different radio signals merged together to make this one, the white one, or based on their different characteristics, which here is the different wavelengths we are dealing with. The choice is here a prism, but we're dealing with the same principle, but with the waves which are not visible to our naked eye, and here the devices would have some radio devices used to this. But why we would need to separate the different signals with different characteristics, because we would like to have different transmitters
signals received from satellites. Some other people interfere with the signals used to navigate the airplane, or when you are on a cruise, you know, having signals used in maritime navigation to be interfered by, for example, the signals used in other transport. So the spectrum is the radio spectrum is divided into several chunks. And each chunk is and this is actually how the spectrum is allocated. This is the chart demonstrating United States reconstruction. Kind of shows that how the different parts of the radio spectrum is allocated to different services and different applications. But the point I'm going to mention with this chart is that frequency spectrum, radio spectrum, there are so many applications, so many demand, so much demand, and we could barely find a new spectrum to allocate a new application. So, but here, although we are seeing that the spectrum is crowded and there are so many applications, measurements show that the spectrum actually is not properly used. This precious and valuable communication resource is being underutilized. The measurements in many different cases have shown that on urban areas, the utilization efficiency of the spectrum is something like 12 to 15%, maybe at most. So most of the time, this spectrum is not used properly. And the main reason is that we have allocated the spectrum to different services. We allocate the spectrum usually to an operator based on the license. Grants the operator a long-term exclusive right to use the spectrum, and no one else can use that spectrum. And because of the current unadaptability of the current spectrum policy, management policies, the use of the spectrum is not efficient. So we need to find better spectrum utilization by improving the efficiency in the spectrum. And when we say the spectrum is underutilized, we are meaning that there are some vacant spectrum bands over time and space, which are not being used at certain times and at certain locations. And one way to make advantage of these dynamically available spectrum bands is in a dynamic manner. It means we have some sort of adaptive radios which can identify these spectral opportunities and change their parameters to use the randomly available spectral opportunities. And this is the concept of dynamic spectrum access. And we call these spectrum holes or white spaces, the random spectral opportunities. And this is the concept of dynamic spectrum access, and we that this can improve significantly the efficiency. Dynamic spectrum access is commonly realized by the concept of cognitive radios. Cognitive radios are special kind of radios which have certain capabilities known as self-awareness, context awareness, and adaptability. First, they should be adaptive. And second, they should understand the situation. They should have some perception of the situation. They should be self-aware, which means they should know about their own parameters and what it implies about the situation of the radio communication. And they should be context aware. They should know about their environment, for example, the spectral resources. There are various definitions of CR. I have provided one of my most favorites, but I think it's more intuitive to take a look at cognitive radio architecture here. First, we see that it's a feedback loop. For any engineer in this room, a feedback loop means we are dealing with an adaptive system. I would like to mention that we are dealing with adaptive radio, which has a sensing part, and it includes some processes, some cognitive so-called are designed by mimicking the behavior of biological cognitive systems, and this is a good illustration of the concept of cognitive radio. And I think now it is clear why these radios better utilize the available communication resources, and in particular radio spectrum. Of course, there are plenty of applications for such radios, for such useful radios. Whenever we want high performance, low efficient wireless communication, having more spectral resources would be a great advantage. The major capability in cognitive radios is about that sensing work. We are dealing with spectrum sensing in cognitive radios. And this means that cognitive radios listen to their environment. In order to discover the spectral opportunities, which are dynamic and random, they need to inspect their radio environment. So this is a kind of signal processing challenge. And if you study spectrum sensing, you're dealing with a beautiful set of signal processing techniques and theories, and everyone interested in signal processing will find it fascinating working on spectrum sensing. And then the other important thing about sensing quality is that I need to remind you, because you all have used wireless phones, and probably for sure you know that the signal strength we receive in our wireless devices changes. We don't receive the same quality of signal all the time. There is fluctuations in the signal strength based on where we go and how we use the wireless device. And these fluctuations and these signal quality degradations are adherent to the wireless environment. And of course, these degrade the quality of spectrum sensing. A technique we use to improve the quality of the spectrum sensing is to establish cooperation among are spread over a geographical area, and they can share the information they get by their own individual sensing, and then they could come up with a decision about the spectral opportunities available by cooperating with each other. And here is a simple illustration. Here we have radio networks CR1, CR2, and CR3, and they are trying to sense their environment and to see if this so-called primary user is using its spectrum or not. The vacant bands allocated to this primary user. And because of certain wireless environment degradations, for example, CR3 is outside the range of this transmitter, so it cannot perceive the activation of primary user. If these cognitive radios are connected and cooperating, we can avoid such cases where unreliable sensing results are. Spectrum sensing. Cooperative spectrum sensing is a three-phase process, composed of three steps: local sensing, reporting, and decision or data fusion. In local sensing, each radio performs its own individual sensing based on its own sensor. Each type of radio has a sensor, if you remember that diagram I showed. And then in the second phase, they report the sensing outcomes to a special node called the fusion center. And then at the fusion center, the received reports are combined together, and the decision about the availability of the spectral resources are made here at the fusion center. So we are dealing with a three-phase process, and in each phase, we are dealing with a different kind of problem. In the local sensing, we are dealing with extracting a signal from noise. In the different problems at each phase. And what we did, in this dissertation, we inspected all these details all these phases in detail, and then we identified several trade-offs considering each of the phases. We also considered the design, the joint design of several phases, for example, the reporting phase and the fusion phase. We identified several trade-offs, and we justified why we expect better performance in considering and taking into account those trade-offs. We provided mathematical modeling of the system based on those trade-off modeling, and then we provided several new designs for better cooperative sensing, and it can be categorized into three steps. good state. We saw the architecture and definition of cognitive radio, why it's important, how it works, the main building blocks of it. And we saw the spectrum sensing capability and how it enables the cognitive radios to understand the situation, to have some knowledge and awareness about the situation and how it affects its performance. And then we saw that cooperative spectrum sensing can provide more reliable spectrum sensing for cognitive radios, which in turn provides better spectrum utilization. And this provides more efficient and more reliable communication systems. And this was an overview of the research topics. Nine publications, six of them included in the dissertation, one of them submitted recently, and two under. If somebody is interested, I can.
Now, may I ask Professor Yunti, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, to present your comments to my thesis that you see justifiable?
Okay, thank you. Okay, so today we are discussing some topics related to wireless communications and connectivity, which can be considered as one of the enabling infrastructures of the modern society. So if we think past like 20, 30 years ago, very few of us were continuously connected wirelessly. We may have had telephone in our home, maybe not even everyone had a telephone wired, so you couldn't reach anyone at any time like it's now. And during the last, say, 20 years or so, all the businesses have been revolutionized by the development of internet, wireless connectivity, and that's really changing the world. It has been changing, and it seems that it will time. So, for example, if we look at some of the statistics from Cisco and other network service provider, well, network infrastructure providers, we are currently transmitting something like 6 to 7 exabytes of data per year, and that's expected to be increased by sixfold or within the next 5 years, maybe tenfold within the next 10 years, and so on. So continuous increase in the data traffic is what we see because of the digitalization, because of the changing businesses and all that. What does it mean to technology? It means that we really need to work hard to provide the connectivity, both in the core network, in the optical transmission that area, and there are big challenges in the wireless area. And that's one of the key motivations why new wireless systems like 5G enabling enhanced broadband connectivity, higher rates, better services, better fidelity for video and so forth is being developed. And it's increasing also the so-called machine type connections where we have more and more connected devices because of the Internet of Things, everything and so on. And the key technologies how we achieve these goals are that we need definitely more spectrum. We need improved spectral efficiency on the system and network level. That means technology improvements. And we will probably need small cells, network densification, massive MIMO, all these fancy technologies. But as important part of the enabling technologies for the future digitalization and connected society, we also need to use the existing, so-called existing frequencies. The frequencies for the infrastructure, we have the basic technology, we need to use those more efficiently. And that's what the dynamic spectrum access paradigm and the thesis of today is about. And in that sense, the thesis is very timely, and the topic it's covering is something of real, practical engineering, and also in that sense, I'm expecting very timely and insightful discussion. Okay. So with these words, maybe we get started with the actual discussion. I think that the kind of usual habit is that we start from a little bit more general questions and then go to the specifics and so on. And I will also maybe examine some of the points in the summary part first and then go to the original papers. Okay, so let's start with a very general question and a little bit personal flavor. So how did you end up in studying dynamic spectrum access and the problem we are facing today? So can you share us your core motivation 4 years back? I heard that you have been in Finland about 4 years. So why this particular topic?
I would say it goes back to probably 5 or 6 years ago, because when I started my master's degree in Tehran at Tarbiyat Madaris University, I was working in cross-layer. I was interested in studying the cross-layer designs in wireless networks, and then there was many cross-layer designs in the cognitive radio context mm-hmm. as well. So while I was studying for my master thesis on cross-layer design in wireless networks, I was getting familiar with the concept of cognitive radio and dynamic spectrum access. And at the time, it was a new topic, and it was very hot topic, and there was a lot of discussions and seminars and presentations and invited talks about cognitive radio. And then the last year of my master thesis, I ended up doing research at Iran Telecommunications Research Center with some people who were working on cognitive radios, and we started collaborating with each other, and I just enjoyed the new and interesting aspect of wireless communication, which is investigated under the topic of cognitive radio. So that's why I got interested in and there was many talks about the effect and importance of cognitive radio and dynamic spectrum access in the future of telecommunications. Especially, I remember I was in a talk at the University of Tehran where Professor Norman Beaulieu from University of Alberta, he was giving a passionate talk about dynamic spectrum access and cognitive radio, and he added this sentence. He said, the future of wireless communication is about cognitive radio and dynamic spectrum access. And I was, mm-hmm. and at that time I was like, okay, I want to be involved in the future of telecommunications. So.
Okay, I think that was an interesting story and good lesson for all of us. So when we give a talk, we should be careful what we say. It may have an impact on someone's career. So, okay, that's important. Okay, in dynamic spectrum access, you have different approaches. And in the class of cognitive radios, you have sort of two main approaches. One is based on spectrum sensing, which is your topic. The other is based on databases and geographical knowledge. So is there a particular reason why you focus on the sensing side? Is it that it has more problems, or is it more promising, any comment on that?
For me, you know, there are two sides. First, I think the spectrum sensing part is more interesting for me, you know, because it gets more into the signal processing and signal estimation detection, and it deals with more pure physical layer problems compared to other ones. And then the other thing is the ultimate cognitive radio network, I would say, wouldn't use the geolocation database, because the whole idea is to be able to establish a network without any supporting resource. But now, because of the practical limitations, because the discussions in cognitive radio is mainly biased by the regulatory and aspects, economic aspects, and the concerns of current operators.
And I think the concept of database is a bit too conservative. To protect those primary users, and to let this technology get evolved, even though there are a little bit, debates on if it can protect or not. But I think at the end, what we mean by a cognitive radio network is to be it's self-dependent and based on its own resources, and finding the opportunistic spectrums based on its own resources. And if there is a database, it should at the end be within the network itself. So that's why I'm more interested in the spectrum sensing part rather than the database.
Okay. Okay, that actually leads quite nicely to the next question. So, okay, you said that the ultimate cognitive radio network would be such that you can realize it without no infrastructure support, very self-autonomously.
That's the purpose of
the cognitive radio. That I agree, no problem with that. But then there is the question that is this approach and this fundamental goal, is it proven that it's in some sense definitely better? And if so, then rigid scheduled access of the old cellular legacy. So in which sense it is better? So can you say that this goal is the right goal?
You mean if there is a proof that which direction is better?
Right.
I haven't seen any proof yet, because actually, when we talk about wireless communication and a wireless network, there can be numerous possibilities of how it can be designed, even just the physical and data link layer, if you just consider. So I don't think I haven't seen anything, concretely, saying this way is better, this way is not. Even the highest, highly reputed organizations like FCC have been dealing with, investigating several scenarios to see which one is better. And actually recently, I think in 2011, they rejected, for example, the paradigm of underlay transmission, because they said even though there are plenty of resources in the literature supporting this, field measurements show that this the concept of interference temperature cannot protect our primary users. So first of all, I don't think there is any concrete proof, because there are so many projects going on now in industry level and academic level investigating those things in a narrower perspectives. And then the other thing is, I think the concept of database is a supporting factor for this technology to grow, and after growing, probably when we have more advanced technologies, probably we wouldn't need that at the end. So I would think spectrum sensing, it's at least from my point of view, it's better to invest on.
Okay, I think we can easily agree on that you cannot practically prove which is better, and will definitely depend on the context. Okay, so basically, if we somehow conclude the general topic, I would say that you said that cognitive radio with spectrum sensing has big potential, and it's interesting problem, and that's why we are discussing about it. And yeah, that I can definitely agree, no problem with that. Okay, if we then go more concretely to your thesis and some statements here, and start maybe from the introduction, and that starts on page 15, I think. Is it so? Yes. And there you mention, when you start, you mention limited battery lifetime, global warming, energy consumption as the key motivators. So now going back a little bit back to the previous question, so are there now some clear proofs or clear evidence that cognitive radio is also more energy efficient? I think that there is quite a bit evidence that in certain cases with underutilized spectrum and all that, you can definitely improve the spectrum efficiency. I think that's pretty well accepted. What about the energy efficiency? That's less compared maybe to that you would have better scheduling and rigid access to the same spectrum. So is it easy to say which is the right way to go in that sense?
Spectrum efficiency is the direct conclusion everyone expects from cognitive radio. Yeah, because the first thing is spectrum sensing, but the energy is actually I have seen several discussions on how energy efficiency can be improved by cognitive radios. The first direct way to interpret this is to consider the Shannon capacity formula. Because in the Shannon capacity formula, we have two factors. One, the bandwidth, and the other one is the energy. Mm-hmm. And both affect the capacity we can get in a communication link. So, of course, if you get more spectral resources, for a certain amount of capacity which you are trying to realize, you can use less power. Mm-hmm. In general, if we would like to, provide a general statement. Mm-hmm. Okay. But of course, it depends on the implementation detail and all the stuff, because as we discussed, cognitive radio is not a simple radio. It has so many, aspects.
Yeah.
So we should be careful to, when we are designing these new features in the network, we don't end up with extra energy consumption for realizing those features. But in general, if we can end up with a significant amount of efficiency in spectrum utilization, we can have a better, probably less energy consumption as a side product mm-hmm. by using
okay.
that. But we can go even higher. We can discuss even with a higher level. When we discuss about the concept of cognitive radio, we talk about some sort of adaptive radios which are aware of the situation mm-hmm. and can adapt their own parameters to realize some goal. This is kind of the major, I would say, my favorite definition of cognitive radio in James Neal's dissertation. I have provided in the dissertation and also in the presentation. I just skipped it to explain the architecture. But this goal and the situation and all the adaptation mechanism can be realized with the purpose of realizing low power consumption mm-hmm. instead of directly dealing with spectrum. So realizing green communication networks is also a parallel topic next to realizing more efficient communication under the umbrella of cognitive radio.
Right.
But we were focused on spectrum sensing. So we can summarize it as this.
Right. So I think that it's definitely clear that looking at the overall energy consumption is much more complicated mm-hmm. issue than just the spectrum efficiency. Okay, you mentioned this Shannon formula. Can you show that? Because I think that that is something we... Can you maybe write it on... Do you remember it, which was the formula you were referring to? Because I think we may need it later in some other points. And there may be something like... Okay, so B is now... Okay. And can you elaborate the SNR so that B appears there as well, the capacity of the bandwidth channel?
The bandwidth of the link.
Or the gamma. Can you elaborate the gamma?
The gamma is actually... the received signal power to the noise power.
Right.
So and you would like to
okay, good. And if you happen to have white Gaussian noise channel, how the noise power can be expressed with bandwidth?
It will be the noise power spectral density times bandwidth.
Okay, good.
And then?
Yeah, that's okay, maybe PS instead.
Yeah, and PS.
Okay, good. So, okay, that's okay.
Yeah.
So now you will have B in front of the log, and also in the argument, right? Okay.
So that's why this is actually considered as more effective to increase the capacity rather than the power, but
right,
because
but
we have saturation.
Yeah, right. But you must be careful there, because if you look at the limit and you keep the power or energy per symbol constant, then you will get saturation also with the bandwidth.
Of course.
So you need always the power. So in that sense, it's not so. immediately clear whether you improve the power efficiency.
That's why I said we should be careful about how we implement the cognitive radio. We cannot just talk about
that. Right. And then maybe another detailed question related to this. So what's the difference between energy efficiency and power efficiency in this context? Is there some difference? So if you maximize your power efficiency, do you maximize the energy efficiency at the same time, or?
When you maximize the power efficiency, you don't necessarily maximize the spectrum efficiency.
No. Power and energy, are they just the same thing here, or is there something more to consider?
What is the purpose? I mean, what is the design purpose here? We are considering these. Mm-hmm. We are designing a network with the purpose of spectrum efficiency, you mean?
No. I'm referring that you mentioned the energy efficiency as one motivator. So is the energy efficiency the same as the power efficiency, minimizing somehow the transmit power?
Mm. The whole point is to get the same communication capacity.
Mm-hmm.
With lower spectral resources or lower power resources.
Okay.
The whole thing is, so we have to formulate an optimization problem. What
right.
we want to maximize okay. with respect to which constraints. So if you want to maximize the throughput, for example,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you have some constraints on the bandwidth or on the energy, you know, it depends on how you formulate the problem and what priorities you have
sure.
in designing
okay.
your network.
Okay.
So we can formulate a cognitive radio scenario based on maximizing the throughput,
mm-hmm.
with more emphasis on bandwidth. We can design it again, maximizing the throughput, but as the power as the independent variable we are playing
okay.
with. So it depends on the how you design.
Okay, fine. We probably come back to that equation a little bit later when discussing some of the papers. Okay, thanks. That's perfectly fine now. Okay, then still on page 15, the title of the thesis is Cooperative Spectrum Sensing and so on. And on the bottom of page 15, you say in the last paragraph there, how cooperative communication techniques are used to enhance the reliability of spectrum sensing and so forth. So can you refresh what do you mean and what is generally meant by cooperative communications? So what is cooperative communications more precisely?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Usually cooperative communication is linked to, you know, some kind of, for example, relays. Having relays and
that's one example.
You know,
yes.
decode and forward, the relay and forward schemes and
yes.
yeah, for more I would say for more technical readers, those scenarios are more familiar in cooperative communication. But because I wrote this introductory part for a wider, you know, audience,
mm-hmm.
I use this cooperative communication. It is not incorrect from my point of view, because
mm-hmm.
still in cooperative sensing, we are exchanging information between the different nodes in the network. And we have to coordinate this information exchange in order to have a better spectrum sensing compared to those classic cooperative sensing methods, cooperative communication methods, which might be established to realize something else.
Right.
So I would still be in favor of having this term here.
Yeah, I didn't oppose it. I was just asking that what do you mean by it. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
that's okay. And I think that you are actually right that all these relaying schemes, they are just one example of cooperative communication. So if you look at the multi-user information theory, which has been around for since 80s and or developing since 80s quite rapidly, there is the concept of cooperation, and it can be actually very general thing, and I perfectly agree that your schemes fit into that. No problem with that, but I think it's good to note and wouldn't have harm to maybe have a footnote saying that what cooperative communications means many of the readers, because I think that someone may expect after this sentence something else that is later there, but I'm not saying that it's any mistake or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good. Okay, then just very minor thing on the some issues in the style of writing. For example, on page 16 in the middle, you say that these new structures are thoroughly analyzed and the associative design issues and so on. I think that I read several times the word or the phrase thoroughly analyzed, and well, not sure whether it's a good term in the sense that someone once thoroughly could be someone else superficially, so just a comment that this term could be disputable always. So I would have maybe avoided it a little bit. But that's more just a very minor comment. Okay, then the introduction is basically showing the structure of the dissertation. And from my side, I'd like to switch to chapter 2, where you then start doing some sort of overview and literature review of the dynamic spectrum access technology. And okay, let me see. Yeah, you have the figure 2 on page 22. You showed the same figure also in the lecture. So I was just thinking on a general level that what kind of sort of practical time and frequency scales you are usually thinking of. You have some 6 megahertz examples in some of the papers and so on, but what do you think, what are the typical, let's say, bandwidths over which you try to scan your frequency band? Practice maybe, so how wide band operation we are talking about?
You mean the practicalities?
Yeah,
practicalities,
yeah.
The currently most discussions, you know, most commonly used discussions are in the TV band spectrum, which are in the scale of megahertz, and the time scales are in the scale of millisecond. Mm, so
right.
So the spectrum sensing, for example, could be in 100 milliseconds, and to scan, for example, 6 megahertz bandwidths in the TV band. And I think, as I remember, in the IEEE 802.22, the time durations for sensing are in the order of millisecond to second.
Right.
So the channels considered are in the TV channels, so are in the order of 6 megahertz. And also one major factor which makes it feasible to implement is that the TV channels don't change rapidly,
right,
as we see in other wireless communication networks. And that's why it is considered as probably the platform for starting and growing the dynamic spectrum access, as the for developing practical scenarios. So the practicalities are mostly discussed and cited in the literature, referred to the TV band spectrum and those numbers. But but we can have others. It depends on actually how much you are willing to spend. You know, depends on how complex you can afford the complexity of your radio.
Right.
You know, in theory, we're not.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I think that one important purpose of this discussion is to understand also the hidden assumptions and hidden limits of your research. And I think that now you touched one of the reasons why I asked this. So, so depending on the bandwidth you are thinking of, you pose different complexity requirements to the radio frequency analog parts of your receiver, and then. In many of your analysis later, you assume that you have white noise and you know the noise level and all that. So I think that the wider the bandwidth, the more sensitive it will be to hardware impairments and knowing all these parameters.
Yeah, the more sampling frequency you need.
Right, you will get more challenging. So, but if you are just on the order of few megahertz, then of course the technology is not that expensive, and you can definitely realize these schemes in practice. Okay, so that's probably not the key hidden assumption, and then later you also mentioned that you usually cannot sense and communicate simultaneously, and that relates to the time scales as well, or the frequency scales, because on the other hand, if you have a very wide bandwidth, you might be able to communicate in one band and then be widely separated in frequency and scan theorem. So that's also somehow assuming some sort of relatively narrow band assumption.
Yes. Yes, we can go actually, yeah, any paragraph in the introductory part of the dissertation can be expanded more and more and more.
Right.
But I was trying to, you know, give an overall a picture for the reader about the spectrum sensing and the type of trade-offs we are facing. Of course, if there is someone willing to discuss more, we can go to, you know, more complex systems and even consider full duplex systems which can transmit and send at the same time. But we also have to take into account the challenges we encounter in dealing with those systems. Mm. For example, the requirement for high isolation between the transmitter and receiver to avoid self-interference, that would increase the dimensions of the problem. So,
but that's a good point. So full duplex would definitely be an interesting technology for.
Yes, I think I have included that in the published version as a footnote.
In that part
that one might consider full duplex systems because it is currently a topic at drawing attention to realize the sensing and transmission at the same time.
Okay, right. And then another point on the same page 22, you mentioned here that awareness, the last paragraph, awareness regarding the radio environment and user needs can be seen as context awareness, and then there is the self-awareness. So in a way, is this here to say that the cognitive radio and agility to spectrum conditions is just, let's say, a special case of a wider perspective, or how does this paragraph relate to the big picture? So that's saying that actually true cognitive radio would do more than just be agile in the frequency use, or what's the point you mean this?
Yes,
context?
Actually, the big picture, the whole big picture, and actually when I provided a definition for cognitive radio on page 24, I didn't use any definitions focusing on spectrum.
Right.
I have used the definition which mentions to autonomously adapt towards some goal. So this is the big picture, and I have explained these general aspects, you know, go down into these parameters in the scenarios we have considered. But of course, when we talk about cognitive radio, we are talking about a general system, a general adaptive system, cognitive system composed of general cognitive processes, which are attaining information about their own situation. The situation can be considered as the environmental situation and their own parameters status, and they are adapting their parameters to realize some task in a certain environment. And then when I discuss about the awareness, I don't think I mentioned about the spectrum per se.
No, right.
And then at the end, I clarify that for the scenarios considered in this paper, we can associate these concepts with these parameters, for example, the spectrum, user needs, quality of service, and et cetera, et cetera. But the concept of a general cognitive system does not have to deal with the spectrum. It doesn't even have to deal with radio communication if we talk about a general cognitive system.
Sure, yes.
So yes, I think I have maintained the generality of the explanations for a reader to understand it in that generic level, and then I have tried to narrow the view down to the purposes of our papers at the end of the dissertation.
Right. So in the broad sense, maybe any radio, not quite any radio, but almost any radio in high-end cellular handset is in a way cognitive, because it's cognitive to the variations in the impulse response of the channel and so on. So in a very broad sense, you can...
Actually, they are. We were having this discussion in another meeting recently. Those are widely considered. We should consider them as adaptive policy radios, okay. Not cognitive radios, mm-hmm. because they are somehow working based on a set of rules we dictate to them. But cognitive radio, in general, based on what we see as cognitive process mm-hmm. and cognitive reasoning, and the cognitive engine. The outcomes of these modules are not deterministic always, and are somehow different with mm-hmm. with what we have in the policy-based radios, policy-based mm-hmm. adaptive radios, because you know these systems might have their own reasoning and learning capabilities, and depending on how these reasoning and learning capabilities are realized. They could show different behaviors in similar situations compared to those policy adaptive radios.
Okay, I understand your point. I'm not sure if all of your policies here with requirement for the constant or approximately constant false alarm rate and so on would actually differ that much, because some of the policies are pretty well defined and probably will result in the same solution once you repeat. So I'm okay, I understand your point, and I kind of agree with the general definition, but I'm not sure if all your radio policies would actually satisfy this requirement and be cognitive in this sense. I think that many of them are then adaptive or whatever was your definition. Okay, maybe we can move on from this anyways. Okay, then a minor comment on page 20. So here in the middle, 27. In the middle of page 27, you say that this type of secondary network is shown in figure 8. Do you mean possibly figure 4, or is there something I miss? Is that a typo or? Figure 8 is pretty far away and shows to me something.
I think it's
else.
A typo.
Okay, so that's figure 4. Okay, fine.
Yes, it's a.
Okay, right. And then the question about this figure 4. You have two options here, cognitive radio network with infrastructure and without infrastructure. And most of the analysis you perform applies as such either of. But is there any hidden assumption favoring one of over the other, whether there is infrastructure or not in your work? I don't have an answer. I'm just asking that. Did you have something in mind when you sketched all your assumptions and models?
When I sketched all my assumptions,
yeah,
I worked based on papers working on centralized cooperative sensing.
Okay,
because nowadays the practical assumptions is based on centralized. Because if you want to realize ad hoc mm-hmm. cognitive radio, it has much more issues.
Yeah, sure. So
now the because when you want to clearly focus, for example, on one phase of spectrum sensing, because the spectrum sensing is composed of several different challenges. So assuming centralized cooperative sensing mm-hmm. would give you more opportunity to focus on a certain building block in the cooperative sensing, and gain more knowledge about how it works without getting into practical difficulties of establishing a ad hoc network. The other reason is the most commonly used industrial, or I would say practical example of cognitive radio in the literature is the IEEE mm-hmm. standard of 802.22, and that is also infrastructure based. And that's why so many cognitive radio works are working based on that, because it's the most commonly used practical cognitive radio scenario. So if you develop a new cooperative sensing in a centralized scenario, it means you are more close to the most practical case considered in the literature. So you can have more attention.
Right.
So that's why I prefer to work on the centralized cooperative sensing.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I assumed. But on the other hand, of course, you could have some distributed policy to decide that each one of the nodes serves as central node and all that. But yeah, agree that the thesis itself favors somehow thinking it as a infrastructure based with the centralized node and all that.
Can I add something?
Yeah, sure.
You know, when you assume infrastructure based, you just add some assumptions on how the information is exchanged, how the information is provided in the fusion center.
Right.
So, based on general modeling of, for example, a certain set of sensing outcomes available at the fusion center, it doesn't affect your perspective and your design concerns when you're dealing with the fusion center and the decision making at the fusion center. That is something probably another problem to deal with. So when we are focusing on spectrum sensing, detection, decision, fusion, you know, how to establish cooperation, I mean, how to distribute the load of cooperative sensing among the sensing nodes, you know, those assumptions dealing with whether it is centralized or it is ad hoc, you know, go to the next level. It doesn't affect much. So from my point of view, by some minor changes in the results we have derived in the centralized scenarios, we can apply them to the...
Agree. That's what I basically more or less meant saying, that you could have some on top of protocol on the network level saying that, okay, this could be the node serving as the central node collecting the information,
yes, exactly.
Maybe forwarding. Yeah, fine. Maybe one more question on the on chapter 2. So you mentioned here 4 possible applications of cognitive radio networks, and surely there are others as well. So do you think that? So yeah, the question. So do you think that the cognitive radio will play an important role also in the wireless sensor networks or Internet of Things type of applications? Of course, some of the applications you mentioned here belong to that, but
actually,
let's say...
Currently, there are many papers dealing with cognitive sensor networks.
Right.
If we consider that as a sign that in future we will see more... you know, application of cognitive radio in the sensor networks, yeah, definitely. Because, of course, in a sensor network, we have so much stringent restrictions about the power, about the bandwidth, and about the communication facilities between the low cost and small sensors with the data gathering unit.
Right.
So these, you know, stringent constraints and restrictions, you know, actually would require more resources to have, you know, to realize them with low cost. And that's why I think cognitive radio and cognitive sensor networks, because they are using the resources more efficiently, are good candidates for realizing those sensor networks. And when I mentioned here about the smart grid, actually smart grid is a kind of sensor network.
Yeah, agree. Yeah,
I would say it's one of the most practically appealing sensor networks.
Yeah.
Because we can see its direct impact on our society.
Yeah, yeah, I agree, and I think that some of the medical applications also belong to that frame.
Yes,
sure. Yeah, because I think also that is potentially one interesting area for cognitive radio technology, definitely. Yeah.
Can I add?
Yeah, sure.
In wireless medical networks, actually, the main problem which makes cognitive radio as one of the appealing candidates is not those restrictions in the resources. Is the problem of coexistence, because mm-hmm. in a for example in a clinic or in a hospital, if you are talking about sensor networks, you're talking about several different kind of sensors working at the same time in close proximity to each other, and based on what I read in the literature, for most of them, the practical standards or technologies we have are based on the ISM band, and we have serious issues in the coexistence of several neighboring devices in the ISM band. I'm sure our friends know that their Wi-Fi router doesn't work sometimes, not because we don't have much power or bandwidth problems, because in a building there are so many Wi-Fi routers, and they might interfere with each other because they are all sharing the same spectrum. So in the sensor networks as used as body area networks or in medical wireless networks, the main issue is the coexistence rather than limitation of resources. So that's why cognitive radio can play a significant role there, because cognitive radio is also a good candidate for realizing coexistence.
Right, sure. Okay, so I think we are ready to move to some questions on chapter 3. So here we go more to the technical contents and introduction to the actual topic. So the second paragraph on page 33, you say that when sensing the radio spectrum, cognitive radios conduct the binary hypothesis test based on statistical characteristics. So that's the framework you are focusing on, and that's fine. That's kind of classical case for spectrum sensing. But one background question for that. So in chapter 2, you mentioned these different dynamic spectrum access policies, license share access, license assisted access, and then citizen broadband radio service, where you can have sort of three user classes, primary users, and then sort of priority, secondary,
priority
and the best effort, secondary. So from the best effort, the lowest class perspective, is there any need for ternary decision making?
Is there anything for ternary?
Ternary, because your actual question is about chapter 3, where you say that you focus on binary hypothesis testing. That's just a question, that is there need for a three-level decision making, whether the primary is there, whether the priority secondary is there, so that I can enter, or so is this, is there actually a three-level decision making in some cases relevant? What do you think?
Depends. Okay, these are two different questions. The first thing is, in that scenario, CBRS.
CBRS.
Citizens Broadband Radio Service.
Yes.
CBRS, yes.
Yes.
In CBRS, depends if you are the priority, the priority access, or you are GAA.
Yeah, if you're GAA. That's
if you're GAA, it's just binary. You should just be careful. There is no one there.
Right, but if
because you don't, you should protect everyone.
That I agree. Yeah, in that sense, yeah, that's what
it's
I was
just
thinking. But then on the other hand, if the signal characteristics of the primary and the secondary are different, so would you benefit if you have three different hypotheses?
Of course, and it does.
Yeah.
It's not dependent on those scenarios. Even in cases we are secondary and there is just one primary. The more information we get from the primary user signal, the better we can react to resources. You know, because for example, imagine I'm a secondary user and there are four different primary users. When we say four different primary users, we say four different behaviors, four different statistical behaviors. If we can distinguish between the primary users by some signal processing techniques or some extra information we get, probably by some sort of extra information exchange or some sort of database or any other possibility. If we can distinguish between the primary users, probably we can infer more information about their behavior, And we can use this information in the decision-making process, not only in the spectrum sensing, but in other aspects of the cognitive radio, such as a scheduling, you know, or a routing, or, you know, it's a general topic. So the more information we get from the primary users, the better available resources we have. And it also depends on how sophisticated our sensing method is, and how complex and how expensive the hardware we are dealing with is, and how much information we have from the prime users, how much source we have to get the information from the prime users. Yeah. So, in any case, it is good to have more information and to distinguish prime users.
That I completely agree. Okay, that's a very good point. We may come back to that view a little bit later again. Okay, so okay, another, let's say, sort of basic starting point question. So on page 35, you mentioned the second paragraph, the detector design based on Neumann-Pearson criterion is the commonly used method. Again, I completely agree, and that's the sort of mainstream of your thesis research. So are there some serious competing alternatives, or is the Neumann-Pearson the only criterion one could think of? For?
This is common because here we directly formulate the performance of detector based on probability of false alarm and probability of detection. And we can easily transform these into two important factors in the cognitive radio that we are dealing with. First, the capacity we get, so which means the quality of service we can offer to the secondary user. And second, the interference experience by the primary users. These are two main factors that we are concerned in designing a cognitive radio, and that makes us, you know, see the Neyman-Pearson criterion more favorable. Mm-hmm. But the problem with Neyman-Pearson approach, as you can see in the papers, is if you want to directly formulate the performance and derive the false alarm and misdetection probabilities and optimize the system performance, you will end up with big equations, non-convex optimization problems, you know. You know, large, I would say big mathematical challenges. There are other approaches. For example, there are some approaches to maximize the distance between the distributions of the global test summary in two cases, the presence or absence. And I have studied some papers about those, and those end up with less complicated mathematics. But I can say the major reason Neyman-Pearson is highly appealing because it directly translates into the network parameters we are concerned in the cognitive radio. That's why we have used that.
Right, and then the other problem sometimes is that there are some parameters you need to know, estimate, and if they are too time varying, that may not be possible.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, right, sure. Okay, that's fine. So I think we are more or less happy with the Neumann-Pearson as a starting point criterion. Okay, then on page 36 you mentioned, is it 36? Yes. You say that the the reporting channels are orthogonal, so is that somehow crucial assumption, or why did you make this assumption?
No, it's a straightforward assumption for assuming that we can receive different reportings from diverse sensing nodes.
Without interference?
Yeah, without interference, and we can distinguish them.
Okay.
I mean, as I mentioned about the difference between centralized and ad hoc, this is not a major concern. We have assumed a general channel for the reporting. If you wish, we can redo all the analysis based on changing just the contamination, the type of contamination in the reporting. But this is a commonly used structure, and it also fits to the assumptions made by made in the development of IEEE standard 802.22.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's practically fine.
Yes.
Yeah, I just thought exactly what you said, that basically I think that most of your work would actually generalize, because you make the reporting channel binary, so you have probability of error. So if you skip the orthogonality condition, you would you could potentially save some bandwidth in the reporting channel, but then probably your probability of error would increase.
Yeah, you can still have the binary symmetric channel with a different parameter.
So I might have, very minor thing, I might have mentioned that, this is just technicality, but doesn't really reduce your generality.
I think first paper of, because I didn't want to mention everything I have mentioned in the papers in the introductory part. I think we have discussed this in detail, why we have used this model.
Yeah, it may be actually there. Now once you say it, maybe in the paper. Yeah. Okay. Right. That's true. Okay, then on the following page, 37, you mentioned that you have block fading model. Can you elaborate now precisely what is the block? What is the block fading? So what is the assumption of the length of the block?
Well, it depends on your channel coherence time.
Well, okay, but I mean here, you say that you have block fading. What does it mean?
It means we have constant level of channel gain during the detection interval.
Okay, so it's from the detection perspective.
Yes,
okay,
we mean the channel gain does not change while we are sampling in the sensing. So when we model the sensing outcome, we assume a constant level for the channel gain.
Okay.
So the statistical behavior would be caused by noise, and that's why
Okay. And does the detector, does it need to know the coefficient H, the level of the...
Sorry?
When you are doing the spectrum sensing, you are running the energy detector or you are running the cyclostationary detector, do you need to estimate the channel coefficient, this H sub I?
You need to estimate the channel power gain, not the channel... not the phase.
Okay, so you need to estimate the amplitude. Okay.
Yes. You need to estimate two factors. When you are dealing with, for example, energy detection, you need to estimate the channel noise, and then the wireless channel power gain, which doesn't need the phase, and it is practically estimated in the literature that I have cited in the papers.
Yeah, you cite. Okay. Yeah. Can you explain then? Do you listen to some primary user pilot sequence, or how do you estimate the channel from the primary?
Yes, actually, these practical issues are the reasons IEEE 802.22 is used, because they have considered these practicalities before. So we just go there and see how these parameters are estimated, and then we just use them. And because in the TV band, for example, first you know where the channels are, and then second you know with what standard they are transmitting. The signal is transmitted, so you know the structure of the signal, and then you have a perception of the transmitted power in the TV station. So based on these information, you can estimate the channel power gain, and if you monitor an empty channel, you can estimate the noise level in the channel.
Right.
So practically, it is possible to achieve these, and there are lots of works assuming these.
Okay. Yeah. Agree. So the hidden assumption here is that you cannot have much mobility, for example, for the primary user, and maybe not that much for the secondary user, so that the the channel power profile doesn't change too much, because you cannot estimate it maybe
there
very
isn't,
often.
There isn't much mobility as in IEEE 802.22.
In the TV channel, in the TV application, sure.
And that, and as I mentioned in the beginning of our discussion, that's why in TV band devices, they need the database to support this.
Right.
Because we are still far away from the ideal cognitive radio technology.
Okay. that's good. Okay, so then a question may be related to the model on pages 37 to 38. You have the, first of all, you have the model in equation one, you have the signal plus noise, and noise is assumed complex Gaussian, which is standard assumption for the white noise. Then you have the energy detector and you square, and then you show that this is actually, the output is, normalized output is a key square distributed, and then you can approximate that also with central limit theorem as Gaussian. Now, can you look at the equations 7 to 10 and tell me, are you completely happy with those? And maybe you can derive or explain briefly, use the board if needed, how you get to 7 and how you get to 9. I have some doubts on some of the expressions, so can you convince me? If not detailed derivation, just explaining the key ideas, so maybe I get convinced then.
To explain.
Well,
so
seven and nine. Yeah, for example, I think then the same logic applies to 8 and 10.
Yes.
If I get convinced one of, I'll get the others as well.
So, according our model to in equation one,
okay,
x of I, the samples of x are normal random variables.
Okay.
So if you sum the absolute value squared of normal random variables, it will end up with chi squared distribution as we see. But if you want to find the mean, you will have to find the mean of the sum, which is the sum of the means.
Right.
And the mean of normal random variable squared is
I got convinced on that. Can you show the other one too?
In that case, this one would be
No. I mean the variance.
You need the variance.
Yeah, the variance.
That's easy, because this is the square root of a normal random variable. The distribution is exponential. So, you know, if it's just, if you have y equals this, and this is a normal random variable, this will be an exponential random variable. So it will be. And then
chalk. So let's repeat. So this was. And now you're saying that variance should be this.
No, variance of this.
No, no, yeah, the variance of this guy, which is the equation.
No. The variance of sum n. We're talking about the sum n. We're just talking about one element of the summation.
Okay, let me see. Right, but in equation 9, you have the variance of.
Yes, but it's the sum of variances because these are independent.
Right.
So if you just calculate the variance of this term
mm-hmm.
and then put an n behind it, it will be the variance of this term.
Right, and that you are saying it's n times.
Yeah, because there will be the energy inserted in the variance of this, energy of s.
Right.
And then you will have this factor here, eta. Then you can write it this way because this is.
Yeah, but if I. So that it's n times sigma I.
I think it would make sense because. Ui is in the order of 2.
Yes.
So the variance should be in order of 4.
Right.
That's I think fine. it makes
yeah.
sense.
So that's the point. So I think that you are missing one. Yes, but from the end.
No. And the squared is whatever we have in the squared comes from this, but n is outside the squared. N comes here. I think we should do it again.
Yeah, we can maybe do it.
But it's easy.
Later, but I think that because if you look at the basic definition and you take square of the definition. Okay,
that's incorrect.
Are you sure?
I think so, yes. Because we don't get the squared of this variance. We get the squared of this variance and there is no n in this.
But isn't this variance of
this is the
u.
variance of the received signal.
Is it the variance of u?
No,
or variance
no,
of
first
uh-huh.
when you are squaring
okay.
you are dealing with this variance and then that's why n comes at the end. That is wrong.
Okay. In that case, I'm not okay. So if you're calculating the variance of received signal x, variance of u.
Yeah, and that's why it has only n, not n squared.
Okay, then I think that, maybe you should have the denominator.
Sorry?
Okay.
No, we are interested in the variance of the decision variable.
Right.
The decision variable is u. We are interested in the variance of u because we are interested in the distribution of u. But we use the variance of x to find the variance of u.
Right.
And there is no n in the variance of x.
Audience, we can get back to that, but I'm not completely convinced. But I think that I assume that your results seem to still to be fine. But this particular equation, we can check that later. Okay, then you have as the next item the cyclostationary detection, which is the other alternative, which is somehow similar to the energy detector. Now the difference is that you take more time lags of the autocorrelation function and then use the cyclostationarity to get more information on the received signal. So in general, as we see later in the examples, get more information, but you typically need more data for that. And it's a bit similar, as I said, to the output of the energy detector, so 13 and 2 are somehow similar, but the difference is somehow that in 13 you normalize by the number of summons, so you multiply 1 divided by n minus l. So would it, if you would do the same in 2, I mean, normalize this by n, would this be more easily comparable, or is there some reason or convention why you don't normalize two?
No, you can easily, I mean, there is no difference because, can I sketch something? You know,
sure, absolutely.
You know, at the end you will, you have one decision variable, let's say u.
Yes.
And two hypotheses.
Right.
So two PDFs.
Yeah, I understand.
It doesn't
matter
how you scale this.
I know.
Differences matter. You
know? I know.
That's why many references use, you know, normalize. Many of them don't.
Right. Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. But if you want to harmonize, if you
the
equations,
yeah.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
We should put the.
Yeah. So there is no particular reason why one is normalized and the other one is not. Okay. Okay, then on figure 6 we have the complementary receiver operating characteristics, which is sort of core of your work where you measure the, which you use to measure the performance of your, most of your schemes, so that's perfectly fine as such. Okay, so in some sense I think that if I got you correctly, the heart of your actual work is the basic configuration in figure 8, and then the model you are spelling out in section 3.3.3 with all these linear combining schemes and all that. And I think that the core reason why you are focusing on the linear combining at the fusion center is the simplicity of the implementation and analysis. And yeah, I agree that the likelihood ratio tests as such as optimally realized are probably too complex for practical realization, so in that sense the choice is fine, but are there any other competing alternatives for this, like belief propagation or some iterative nonlinear processing schemes?
We don't go to nonlinear processing.
You
scheme.
Don't go, but
no. I mean, in general, I don't think you will find any nonlinear fusion process,
right.
Because it's already it's, you need to characterize the behavior of your decision variable statistically, which means you need to calculate its distribution function. If you build the decision variable as a nonlinear function of a set of other random variables, you are dealing with lots of, you know, calculations just because you have chosen an unlinear transformation. Mm-hmm. So no, practically, this is not good. And we can realize the optimal performance of LRT by a linear transformation. Why would we go to a nonlinear transformation? Because we know that this linear transformation gives the optimal performance of LRT. It was proven in UCLA in 2010 in one particular paper. So why would we need that?
Okay, right. So that's basically the motivation. That's fine. Okay, so I think that completes the questions on chapter 3, and then chapter 4 is kind of summary of the papers, more or less with some discussion. And okay, maybe one question about the chapter itself related to something you have on page 51, figure 11, and then the the cases you mentioned here. So you have three cases which you are representing in this figure, and they are sort of covered in many of your papers as well. So you have uniform linear combining, optimal linear combining, and the proposed joint optimization with the combining and number of quantization bits. So somehow this is the logic you run through many papers, at least through papers 1 to 5. And some of the simulation parameters remain the same, some vary, so there will be in some papers five secondary users, in some papers 3 secondary users. So is there some reason why you didn't keep the basic assumptions the same? It would have been nice from the thesis perspective.
The major reason to change the parameters of some simulations in the conference paper was the deadline of the conference approaching to run the simulations in a more quickly, the Monte Carlo simulations.
Okay, I understand. That's understandable reason, yeah. Then but it would have been nice to see the same comparison in the thesis maybe later.
We were focused on the theory mainly, and you can test it with any number of, you know, sensing nodes.
Yes.
We were trying to show that, okay, this sensing improvement is realized. Why is realized? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't, from my perspective, it doesn't matter how many sensors you have used, but yeah, you can make comparisons. But I personally, I have done a lot of comparisons, and I don't think we will end up with new things.
Yeah, I don't think that the conclusions would not change, but somehow the comparison would have been easier.
Yes, of course, it would give a more harmonized set of simulations.
Yeah.
But
and
yeah, I had some
for
time
for conference limits. Deadline. I understand for thesis it would be nice to have the same. But okay, that's the thing. Okay, so I think we can now go and discuss some items related to some of the papers. Okay, so if we start from paper 1, okay, I don't know if there is now page numbering of the thesis, but that let's refer to the page numbers of the papers then. Okay, I think paper 1 is probably sort of your basic work, sort of setting the basic framework and basic foundation, if I got it right. And and here we have now the model and all that. So first detailed question related to the model. So you have the binary symmetric channel from sensor to the fusion center, and of course there might in generality be some coding involved, but in some sense you are not explicitly considering any channel coding protecting from errors. So is there a reason for this, or what's the motivation?
I don't think it's necessary. Whatever you assume, you will have the same binary symmetric channel with probably a different probability of error. So
right.
when you say we model a channel as binary symmetric channel, you can merge all those assumptions about the channel characteristics,
sure,
and channel coding and et cetera, into one single parameter. And that's the beauty of...
Yeah, you can, yeah. But on the other hand, if you would explicitly consider certain... Wouldn't you do soft decoding and then sort of soft decision making over the channel code and the underlying sort of distribution?
Okay, you
in that case
you mean we consider a joint consideration, I mean a joint design of the source coding and
even
the fusion together.
Even that, okay, yeah, I didn't actually, yeah, that's the next step. The first step would be that you have some channel code, like Hamming code, convolutional
mm-hmm.
code, whatever code you would like to. And then you perform soft decoding and this is knowing that, okay, your underlying decision was something that error, so you have a joint distribution over which.
Yes, you can.
And binary symmetric channel is, of course, a sort of simplification of that, and probably something you would like to do in practice, maybe, because.
Yes, but yes, of course. Okay. We can discuss about so many different options in each phase. But while I was working on that particular problem, my main, purpose, my main target was to show that you have to consider both phases together. Mm-hmm. Because papers only focus on fusion, or only focus on local sensing, or only focus on reporting. So my main purpose was to show that if you design two phases together, and if you consider the optimization based on jointly considering the constraints in two phases, mm-hmm. you can improve the performance. And these assumptions were enough to show that idea works. Of course, we can evolve this problem by adding, increasing more and more, dimensions of the problem. But the basic idea and framework will still remain the same. And I think whatever I have assumed in this paper would, is fits to the standard assumptions that we usually evaluate the cognitive radio scenarios with. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but of course, if as you said, we can consider more parameters, including the coding. But it wouldn't alter what we have shown in this paper. I don't think we will end up with a new mm-hmm. set of results.
Well, the results would change, of course, somewhat, but yeah, maybe not the basic concepts wouldn't change that.
Yeah,
much.
That's the that joint yeah. optimization yeah. framework will still remain the same. Yeah.
Right. Okay, then on page 4353, you mention here in section 3.a, first paragraph on this particular page that, okay, for numerical evaluations, we found that the Gaussian distribution fits well for k larger than equal to 5, which I guess is understand well, something I can believe. And then coming back to what we discussed earlier, so in some papers you had k equal to 3. Was that sort of sufficient also then later?
Yes, it was. If you check the figure number 2 and on page 4358.
All right, yeah, you have the CDF there.
Yes, this is only for 5 nodes, and actually it fits perfectly.
Yes.
So we can assume that if you use 3,
it fits also reasonably.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You checked that later?
Yes, okay. I checked that.
Yeah. Okay.
And I can actually justify it.
Theoretically also, or?
I can somehow justify it.
Okay, you can go ahead if you like, yeah. Okay, the next, were you about to say something more, or, yeah, should I go to the next section?
The next.
Yeah, sure, okay. Okay, then you have this, problem two. On page, yeah, the same page actually. So you maximize this Q function by picking W and D. And now, then later on the following page, you say that for given D, so D is now fixed and you are optimizing just with respect to W, you say, second paragraph of section 4, that for given dp, 2 can be solved for optimal weighting vector through considering the Lagrange dual problem and Karus-Kurtuker conditions, which yields the solution, which is okay. But but can you, going back to p2, can you justify why you the KKT conditions give the optimal? Can you show that the argument or the function here is okay, it should be concave because you are maximizing. The overall function is concave so that you're minimizing a convex function. Is that really, that's not obvious to me.
No, no, it's not that, actually.
Okay, why can you then say that the KKT brings the optimum?
First I would say we don't eliminate D by this method.
Uh-huh.
We just replace it with another scalar.
Okay.
Zeta. That's a minor thing. But this based on a constant D.
Constant D, so.
Based on a constant D, right. We can maximize this with KKT method.
And why is that? That's the question.
Because we have it in some paper. They
okay.
have optimized. They have proposed several methods to
okay.
find W.
Is it clearly global optimum? Can you show it's global?
Yes.
Surprised if
because
it's
if you know the KKT doesn't give necessarily the global optimum.
Right, that's the point.
We should have duality zero duality gap.
Exactly.
So either you need to prove that your objective function is convex
yeah,
when you're minimizing or
you need
convex,
strongly convex.
Yeah, or concave when you're
yes.
maximizing, or you need to find all the points satisfying the KKT condition.
Yes.
And then evaluate the
sure.
Hessian matrix.
Right.
I mean this. Yeah. The and then to show that whether this is local minimum, local maximum. And then find the minimum of all the local minimums.
Right. Okay.
So this is done in another paper,
uh-huh.
and they have shown that the KKT has only one global minimum.
Okay, and that was the paper 13.
That was the citation here, 13.
Okay. Okay, that's. A little bit surprising, but okay, I see now your logic and you relied on that. Okay.
Actually, we're not dealing with that problem. We are dealing with the joint optimization, which has
one more.
Yeah,
I know. That's one more step, but this was the first thing which I then got distracted. Okay. All right. Yeah, okay, fine. Okay, then on the results part, that's page 4358. Just below figure 4, you see that it's worth noting that in both figures, case 1, case 2, and case 3 represent the detector design without any optimization, only with the optimal weighting and with joint reporting fusion optimization, respectively. Can you clarify what this sentence means? You have detector design without any optimization, but you have optimal weighting and this reporting fusion optimization. So
sure.
what's this no optimization with optimization?
Yeah, sure. We have two parameters, W. W is how we combine the received sensing outcomes. So to build Y of C. And then D is how we quantize the reports when we set. Okay? And then no optimization would be to set W equals 1. All 1.
Mm-hmm.
Because W is used to discriminate between the received reports.
Okay.
The one with better quality will get a higher weight. The one
mm-hmm.
with lower quality would
mm-hmm.
get a lower rate. Pretty much the same as we do in MRC. So, and then D, we will have, these are the quantizers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ADCs we have, number of quantization levels we have. We have a maximum and a minimum and a minimum a possible number of quantizations. Mm-hmm. So when I say no optimization, I mean all of them the same. And the first perception you get when you want to quantize an analog signal into a digital one, the more quantization levels you use, the better performance mm-hmm. you get.
Yes.
So I will set D to D of maximum mm-hmm. for all of them.
Okay.
So this is case one. And then in case two, we use the existing methods to optimize the fusion.
Right.
So we will set W to W of optimum, and then D equals D of maximum. Only fusion is optimized. This is case two. Then case three would be both jointly optimized.
Okay, right.
So we are showing that how joint design will improve.
I got all this, but now I'm okay. Yeah, I think it's either me or the sentence. So okay, now I get the sentence structure. It's a bit complicated sentence structure. Now I understand what you are saying. Yeah, okay. And this was pretty clear when you had the palliative list, but okay, fine. Okay, so I think that covers most of the questions on paper. Okay, so then a couple of questions maybe on paper two. So basically, this is, if I got it right now, an extension of the fundamental paper one. Now you basically have, if I got it right, sensing device or terminal. And then you look at the enhanced deflection criterion. So is there something more or more contribution?
No, those are the main contributions. Actually, this is direct. You know, these were the material we we had for the first paper, but because we didn't have, we had a 13-page page limit. We couldn't publish this.
Okay, so now if we look at the figure one here and compare it to figure three in paper one or so, basically, do we have the same setup here? So can we somehow compare the receiver operating characteristics and figure three of paper? I think it is the case, or is it?
You need a figure to compare with?
No, I'm just extending my previous question that that are the all the assumptions and all the models in this figure one the same as they were in figure three of paper one, so can I make a direct comparison?
As I remember, yes.
Okay, right. Makes sense. And so if that's the case, then it shows that this EDC, which is a relatively simple scheme, really provides very good performance compared to the optimal ones. And small step, and okay, that explains why you didn't have it in the paper one, because there you needed to run the transient bound, which is pretty complex algorithm. nice extension. Okay, and then if we move to paper three, the key novelty here, if I got it right, is that now you perform sort of transmit of power allocation between the sensors.
Yes, actually, that was pretty much what you mentioned in the first. You know, you mentioned you could consider coding. We added power.
Yes, so that's one step toward that. Yeah, exactly. But now you have the deadline problem that
yes.
You have three users, and I unfortunately was not able to make a direct comparison.
It was an invited paper, so we had to.
Yeah. Okay, I would have appreciated if you had repeated for the thesis. Right, but yeah, that actually, your comment actually leads to the second actual question. So if you now apply coding and the Gaussian channels and coding, you should probably do some sort of water filling.
Mm-hmm.
Or did you look at
no, our main purpose,
yeah.
Our main purpose was the detection. But right. Water filling is mainly about achieving capacity.
Yeah, it is, yes.
So the criteria was different.
It's different, yeah, I agree. But somehow merging these criteria, I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, we can make a nice comparison with water filling. How the power allocation would be different if you consider the objective as maximizing the sensing quality compared to maximizing the efficiency in the reporting phase.
Right.
And how these two objective functions mm-hmm. will reflect in the final throughput of the cognitive radio.
Something like that.
Yeah, that could be a good work.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Okay, that's fine. Okay, let's move to paper four, which then I think brings more novelty. So, so here you have the random interruptions, some sort of random sensoring in a say power. So I guess the key idea here is the power saving, right?
No. One part of idea is the power saving.
Okay, what's the key idea?
The key idea is to better distribute the power used in the different sensors and also to distribute the computational load among the different sensors.
Okay.
Because when the sensor is engaged with one particular channel,
mm-hmm.
which might not contribute much to the overall detection at the end, it could save this resources, use these resources to monitor another channel, probably with a better condition.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the main idea.
Okay.
But because this is first, we have to implement what we propose in a commonly used system, we had to keep it simple first. So we dealt with single channel primary user, and then at the next step, the paper we just submitted to Globcom 2016, that one actually opens the view because it assumes that the reader knows about random interruptions. Now
mm-hmm.
you can consider a wideband spectrum sensing several channels. The major idea is to distribute a certain amount of available communication and signal processing resources among a set of available channels to be sensed.
Mm-hmm.
This is the main idea.
Right.
Yeah, you can call it efficiency. Yes. But but
mm-hmm.
I would like to emphasize that it's more than energy efficiency. I mean,
okay. Yeah, I understand. So there are more extensions.
Yes.
Okay. Then you claim that the random on-off on and off the sensors is, in some sense, than doing this sort of sensoring. Can you explain this? Why do you say that this random random approach is okay? So if you look at
your question, I can explain.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Can you explain intuitively why this is
exactly
better?
In current works that mm-hmm. we have in the literature, yes. they focus mainly on energy consumption, mm-hmm. and they want to reduce the energy consumption by turning off some of the sensors which do not contribute much to right. the overall sensing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so they just turn some of the sensor off by by inspecting their channel conditions, etc. Mm-hmm. And then and that's it. It's kind of channel sensor scheduling or sensor selection methods. But we said instead of just turning this off or on the whole period. For the whole period of spectrum sensing, mm-hmm. you can assign a rate of activation to each sensor. Probably mm-hmm. One particular sensor might not be as productive in the cooperation, but it could provide something. So probably the rate of not getting any cooperation from one particular sensor is not just zero or one. It could be a number between zero mm-hmm. and one.
Okay.
And that's the main idea of realizing random interruptions, because we now introduce mm-hmm. a random number mm-hmm. and you can change the Bernoulli probability. Mm-hmm. So you can actually tune for how percentage of time this sensor is active or inactive, instead of considering it in the whole period, either on or mm-hmm. off. We can set the amount of contribution or the amount of the percentage of time this sensor contributes to the overall detection by tuning this Bernoulli probability and by tuning it. The second difference with this work and the existing works is that, from my point of view, as I did the literature review, this is the first work considering soft fusion mm-hmm. in dealing with sensor selection or sensor scheduling, mm-hmm. because the sensor selection and turning the sensors on and off, it's a simple concept. But when you mathematically calculate everything, mm-hmm. it turns into complicated problems. And because when they want to optimize the system, they put so many simplifying assumptions. And the major assumption is to use hard decision mm-hmm. fusion. So this work is the first one considering soft fusion,
okay.
and that is why we can find a number between 0 and 1, mm, okay. because we are dealing with continuous random variables. I mean, continuous parameters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that was the main difference between this work and the existing works.
Interesting. Okay. Okay, then let's say a minor comment on equation 12. There you see that YC can be modeled as normal random variable. I would say that it's only conditionally normal, but that's of course implicit in equation 2. But in the text, if you want to be precise, it's conditionally normal. Now, if we look at your model here, and for example equation 16, you introduce this theta, which is now binary with certain probability of being 0, certain probability of being 1. So in some sense this is now inducing some sort of sparsity to your model, isn't it? Or could you say so?
Yes, you can interpret it as sparsity.
Right.
In the received sensing outcomes. Yes.
Right. So did you think of looking at these sort of sparsity recovering schemes, which are popular in compressive sensing, to recover whether the signal is there or not, and then mm-hmm. reduce those observations out of the model, and then you would have exactly Gaussian model with no zeros there?
Yeah, sparse signal processing. We can use sparse signal processing in the fusion center. Mm. Yes, I agree with it. I used a different approach.
Sure.
Yeah.
Of course, if your probability parameter of being 1 is close to 0.8, you don't introduce that much sparsity. So I don't know how well those schemes will work, because usually there you assume that the number of non-zero observations is significantly smaller than
small,
the overall.
Yes.
But in general, I think that could be an interesting area to look at. Okay, then then related to this, the previous question, then on equations 20 and 21, sorry, you define the minimum least square error or the linear version of the MMSE criterion, and here I came to think that if you could remove this sparsity part, the zero parts, that would probably improve the data fusion of the MMSC performance somewhat. So if you could focus on the...
What you're suggesting is to replace the compensator with a sparse signal processor.
Right. So first you could, for example, try to identify those sensors which were active by sparse signal processing and then perform MMSC.
But we know which sensors are active.
So you assume that you know which is randomly active, which is...
Yes, we know, because we calculate the random numbers.
Oh, then you know, okay. So it's not the local random variable, so that,
No, we generate them.
Okay, so it's in that sense, it is kind of scheduling based.
Yes,
okay,
exactly.
I see.
So the problem is to find the probability distributions, the best probability distributions.
Okay,
we're not concerned of finding out which one is active.
But that means that you need some control channel to tell to the sensors that, okay.
That's why we have you centralized,
right.
centralized cooperation.
Sure. Okay, I see. Well, in that case, you don't benefit so much from the sparse signal processing approach because you know it already. But if you want to reduce this overhead, you could look at that, okay, you just tell the probability and then they run these locally and then you try to recover who was active, who was not. That might be another, okay, but agree, it's completely new protocol then.
Yeah, now it's different, yes.
Yeah, okay, fine. Okay, that clarifies. Okay, then you perform joint optimization of W and probability distribution, right? Okay, that's what you exactly say. Okay. Let's try to move on. Okay, paper 5 then. Here you now perform joint optimization of W and P and focus on the MDC criterion. Is there anything else beyond the transactions the paper 4, which is new here in paper 5?
Yes. Actually, what we show in paper 5 is much more than just that simple optimization. You know, we kind of confirm the previous work. We show that if you implement random interruptions, you don't need to optimize fusion anymore. And we somehow prove what we claimed in the previous paper, because in the previous paper we said, we are introducing random interruptions to do the job of fusion. Because the linear fusion, here the W is used to discriminate between sensor outcomes.
Right.
We
yes.
said we don't need this W, we just introduce random interruptions and we get the same performance because we are discriminating between the sensors, but in a different way. Now we also included the W, and we showed that the performance doesn't change. So you see, I mean, we showed that the whole process of fusion is performed is realized by random interruptions, and you don't need to consider fusion.
Right, okay, so...
In the previous work, we considered equal gain combining. If you go to numerical results of previous paper,
yes.
In the first paragraph of section 4, we see to have a fair comparison, equal gain combining is considered.
Yes.
So we bypass the fusion. So we said whatever fusion is supposed to do, random interruptions will do. We don't need any fusion. And then here, we optimize the fusion, and we see no further performance gain. So we prove that all the performance gain is achieved by the random interruptions.
Right. Okay, I see. Okay, yes, that's nice. Okay, then final paper 6, that's a little bit different in spirit, so the model is now slightly different. So here you are looking at the sequential sensing. So is it now somehow crucial for the performance how you, in some sense, order the channels? Is there the ordering in which you are searching from the channels? Is it somehow depending on the policy how the primary users use the channels, or is it arbitrary,
This analysis is based on assuming that the probability of presence and absence of primary users are available for each channel.
Yes.
So of course, if you have the probabilities of which channel is empty with which probability, you would prefer to first sense the ones with most likely, which are most likely empty.
Right.
So that's why it makes sense to use sequential channel sensing, not just randomly arbitrarily.
But how is it here? Did you assume that probabilities of the primary user occurrence in each channel is the same, or did you have different probabilities for that?
That doesn't matter because we have analyzed the system performance based on a general parameter representing the probability. But we have used index I, so it means we have different probabilities.
Okay, right, yeah. And then with different probabilities, it would make sense to order the...
Yeah, of course, to make a list.
Right, okay. That was not explicitly mentioned. Okay, now I think it's time to go back to this Shannon capacity formula. If you look at the equation, then you are applying it there. So maybe you can shift the table so that you can show it and explain that. Okay, you have it there. So how do you achieve this capacity? What do you need to know in the transmitter and receiver to get this capacity which you are referring to here?
You would like to achieve this?
Yes.
This is the classic problem of adaptive modulation coding, evaluated by Professor Goldsmith at Stanford. This needs a feedback between the transmitter and receiver, and you need the channel state to adapt.
Practically, theoretically, you may not need the feedback. Practically, you are right, it usually needs feedback. Okay, so what the transmitter needs to know so that it can design the transmission so that you can get close to the capacity?
You need to know the channel gain.
Yeah, exactly. You need to know the instantaneous channel state.
Yes.
The SNR, right. And now if we go to equation 10, what does it say? So you have here two capacities, C0, which is log, the bandwidth is somehow normalized, that's fine. 1 plus gamma S, saying that there is no interference, so you know your channel gain, you know your noise variance, so you know your, and that's how you get this seed sub-zero, right?
Yes.
Okay, and how do you achieve C1?
By knowing the channel gains.
Okay.
And the same way we did in the previous papers.
Okay, fine. And what is this PP?
This is the primary user
power.
Okay. C1 is when we mistakenly transmit.
Okay.
So C1 means channel capacity when we have failed to detect the primary user. So the primary user is there,
right,
and transmitting, so it makes an interference on our link.
Right.
So P of P is kind of interference.
Right.
So this is actually the signal to noise plus interference ratio.
Okay.
So
that I understand.
Yes.
But now the transmitter needs to know that, because otherwise it cannot achieve this capacity. And if it knows that the interference is there, it knows that it should be silent. So I argue that you should never achieve this capacity C1.
You will never see this capacity
C1? Yeah, because if you know that the primary user is interfering, you can accommodate your rate so that you achieve it, but then you should be silent in the first place.
We're not talking about instantaneous information. We're
but
talking
that's
about...
that's what the capacity formula assumes.
Okay, we're talking about this information is obtained offline.
Which information? Sorry.
The capacity when there is primary user on your link. Capacity
yes.
When there is noise on your link.
I understand that, but basically, if you think the operation of the secondary user, so that it can accommodate the rate and modulation and achieve the capacity C1, know the interference level. The interference level, it should know that the primary is there and I need to shut up, I shouldn't transmit.
Yes, but if you know that the only interfering entity is the primary.
Yes.
What, you know, in a general scenario, you are some secondary users.
Yes.
There are some primary users.
Yes.
And this interference, in general, is not known if it is caused by primary user or other secondary users.
Right, but here you are saying that, okay, you calculate everything so that you have...
We just have the level of
failed.
Interference,
yes.
But we don't know if it is from primary
user.
We have modeled it here.
I know, but in the capacity, in this equation then, you explicitly have here the probability that the primary user is there,
yes,
and you have made a misdetection. And then you calculate the capacity, and I claim that this capacity doesn't exist because you need to know that the primary is there, and then you should shut down.
You are right, but when our main, target of modeling and analyzing this, and you know, deriving this equation is to achieve the capacity. No, we are trying to demonstrate the effect of sensing time on the possible capacity you can achieve.
Right.
So
how
would you
sure.
model the effect of that interference? We don't say we have this information. We are demonstrating how sensing time variation would affect the secondary user performance.
Yeah, but I think that ultimately you will actually fail, because if the secondary user is operating according to the spectral policy, it should assume that the primary user is not there. It should adjust its rate so that, okay, I just compensate for the fading channel losses, and then then I transmit, and then I cannot successfully decode because my...
This is an alternative design strategy.
Right.
You can put an interruption in the algorithm. If the interference level is higher than this, it means there is some primary user we should avoid.
Yeah.
But in general, if you don't have that much intelligence in your radio,
but you are aiming at very smart cognitive radios, you know.
No, actually, that's why we are working on TV band. You know, we're not. that is the ultimate aim,
okay.
Of course. But these are the first steps towards that. You know, we cannot accommodate all these issues and all.
Okay, but I must say that I disagree with this equation then. Okay, fine. Because I think that you mentioned earlier that all the extra information helps also the decision making, so this should be a sort of guard for you to stop communicating. Okay, very good. So I think this covers the papers and let's go to a few questions about the summary. So if you need to crystallize your thesis finding in one sentence, what that would be? What would be the core of your thesis? We have had a lot of different interesting things here. But if you crystallize it in one sentence, how would you do it?
I don't know why I want to stand up.
You are free to do it.
The main thing would be, even though we are facing different kind of challenges in different phases of cooperative sensing, by considering them in a joint framework, we can have better spectrum sensing functionalities. And this dissertation has provided guidelines for such a framework, to build such a framework. And of course, you mentioned there are numerous possibilities to add even more and more and more, and the model, you know, use more comprehensive models. But I think what we have built is to show that a joint framework considering all different phases, even though they are dealing with different challenges, would end up with better performance.
Okay. Now if you, in the similar spirit, are allowed to pick one single favorite future research topic, what is outside of these, what would be that one?
I would prefer to work on security aspects of cognitive radios.
Okay.
And especially cognitive radio networks are very vulnerable in the sense that the sensing is vulnerable to security threats. You can feed them with false data.
Okay.
And you know, when the sensing is down in a cognitive radio, it means the eyes and ears of the network is down. So. So I would go to security.
Yeah, that's a good topic. Is it because of your scientific interest or the profile of the university?
Both. I have to consider that too, you know.
Okay, makes sense. Good survival strategy. Okay, then the very final question. Now you have worked 4 years for the thesis, or maybe this is two-part final question. So what is the key learning, not in the cognitive radio, but for you as a scientist, and then what is your piece of advice for the junior students? What would you do otherwise? What's the key learning? What would you do otherwise? Sort of takeaway message for the fellow PhD students.
Okay. What I learned.
Yeah, I'm about doing research, not on cognitive radio. So more general carry-on message for someone else tackling the same problems.
I learned to trust my intuition. I mean, I didn't have that trust, so I was in doubt. But now, when I think of a problem, and something when something pops up, I trust it more than before. So I think when something seems correct, and you feel it, you should pursue it. You know, so that is my feeling about it.
And okay.
And also, I learned so much about mathematical optimization. I enjoyed so much reading many, many papers in mathematical optimization, and I think people working in the mathematical optimization are very, very powerful people and influencing so much. Yeah.
Okay.
So I learned a lot about that too.
Okay. Is there something you would do differently?
Beginning.
Yeah, I mean, in general, what should be done differently so that some.
What should be done differently? I would travel more.
Okay. Good. Okay. So, I assume I need to stand up. So, as the official opponent, nominated by faculty. This is by Younes Abdi Mahmoudi. Concentrates on dynamic. Cooperative spectrum sensing method. In the thesis, uses mainly statistical models. The author's own contribution relates. The candidate is the first author. As is customary in the company. The number of original publications and their the novelty and contributions of the thesis. Practical deployments and further modifications. So the proposed algorithm modifications by no means trivial, so the thesis clearly includes skip some of that to conclude. The candidate has succeeded to make during the oral examination, the candidate has shown the subject matter and also very good capability to defend his
After this, I solicit people who have some critical comments regarding my thesis to ask for address from the Custos.
As there are no questions, the public examination has been concluded.